Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for October 14, 2004. This is Doug Henwood and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And we've got one long topic scheduled for tonight. We'll be speaking with Sebastian Mallaby, who is the author of a new book about James Wolfensohn and the institution he heads, the World Bank, called, appropriately enough, The World's Banker, just published by the Penguin Press. And about midway through the show, we'll be joined by someone from an organization that Mallaby spends a lot of time beating up on in his book, the International Rivers Network. Mallaby doesn't like NGOs in general and IRN in particular, so we'll have a response. But first, we'll get a good dose of what he has to say about his own book, starting at about 15 minutes or so. Before we get there, a couple of announcements. First of all, a frequent guest on the show, Nomi Prinz, will be appearing on a panel 6 days from tonight, today, Wednesday, October 20th, an event sponsored by the think tank Demos that will be at the New York Public Library's Donnell Center at 20 West 53rd Street, 20 West 53rd Street, 6:30 to 8 p.m. There will be Nomi Prinz, and she will be joined, who is the author of a new book called, which is just coming out now, Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America. She will be joined by Greg Palast, who is, of course, I think no stranger to WBI listeners, and John Cassidy, the New Yorker writer and author of the book .com. So, again, that's next Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. at New York Public Library's Donnell Center, 20 West 53rd Street. For more information, call 212-633-1405, extension 533. And then a look at some of the economic headlines. Last Friday brought us the release of the monthly employment report. It showed 96,000 new jobs created in the U.S. economy in the month of September, well below what people were expecting. The average expectations were for around 150,000, but some people, especially those in the right wing of the political spectrum, were expecting much, much more. More than a third of those new jobs came from state and local government. The private sector added just 59,000 new jobs. We lost 18,000 manufacturing jobs, disappointing to return to negative signs after we'd seen a few months of gains. Remember, manufacturing lost employment for, I think, something like 43 consecutive months before hitting bottom earlier this year. But now we're back in the negative column again. That kind of bloodletting, unprecedented in modern history, much worse than what we saw in the early 80s when the term Rust Belt was coined. There were some gains in temporary help services, which sometimes, temp firms, which sometimes can be a portent of future job growth, but it may be that employers are turning to temp workers rather than making permanent hires. The job loss in the recession of 2001 was not very severe by historical standards, but the absolute failure of the U.S. economy to recover or to add new jobs since then has been without precedent. We had a little taste of this in the early 1990s, but this has been much more severe. We're now about 9 million jobs below where we would be if this were a normal economic recovery, and we're about 11 million jobs below where we would be if a long-term trend of the last 50 or so years had continued to prevail. So very, very serious job deficit. The Bureau of Labor Statistics once a year does do an adjustment to its job count based on more complete estimates of employment. They do a month-to-month survey of about a third of all employers, but that's not the complete universe. But once a year, they use unemployment insurance records to come up with a complete count, or very close to complete count. A lot of people also on the political right were expecting a large upward revision. The Bush administration and its allies have been talking for a long time about how the Bureau was undercounting employment and that would finally get adjusted in this annual revision. Didn't happen. They've adjusted upward only by 236,000 jobs, really a very insignificant number, below the kinds of adjustments we've seen historically speaking. So the month-to-month numbers have been very, very close to being accurate. So not much comfort there. Also, a large number of people seem to be dropping out of the labor force. We've discovered that we've experienced again a rather mild rise in the unemployment rate during the recession, which and that unemployment rate has fallen since the recession ended almost 3 years ago. But a lot of people have just been dropping out of the labor force and therefore not being counted as unemployed. The so-called employment population ratio, the share of the adult population working, is down about 2 percentage points from its high, and that 2 percentage points means about 4 or 5 million people. We're now down to 1994 levels. This massive withdrawal from the labor force has kept the unemployment rate from rising. Those counted as not in the labor force have risen by almost a million in the last couple of months. Had the labor force grown in the last couple of months at the more normal rates, the unemployment rate would have been 6.2% rather than 5.4%. If the longer term trend over the last 2 or 3 years, if we hadn't seen this dropping out of the labor force, if instead we'd seen people stay in the labor force and being counted as unemployed rather than just dropping out and not being counted as unemployed, we'd have a jobless rate of around 7% rather than 5.4. So 5.4 is not a high number by historical standards, but it's greatly understating the weakness of the job market. North of the border, it was announced the other day that Canada added 43,000 jobs. The U.S. equivalent would have been 350,000. Canada's about one-eighth the size of the United States. So our northern neighbor is doing an awful lot better job producing new jobs than the United States. So something strange is going on here. This morning it was announced that the initial claims for unemployment insurance, that is the tally of people who've just lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance to sign up for benefits, the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that tally rose by 15,000 last week. This was not a number that was contaminated by hurricanes as it was for the last previous couple of weeks. So this is a real clean statistic. And it does seem like after strengthening for much of the year, the job market is just not doing so well. It does seem to be weakening. So failure to recover continues. Housing market also seeming to slow. Mortgage Bankers Association showing its index of mortgages, both for new purchases and refinancing of old ones, fell last week and the sharpest decline since the spring. So it does seem, well, the number does bounce around from week to week, but it does seem that the housing market is cooling after years of being very, very, very hot. And it was reported this morning that the U.S. balance of trade came in deep in the red, $54 billion in the red, considerably worse than what analysts were expecting. Very weak growth in exports and high oil prices leading to a rise in imports. And this is a drag in economic growth and yet more burden added to U.S. Foreign debts. So not so good on the U.S. foreign trade balance. This can't go on forever, but God knows how it's going to end. The OECD, the Paris-based think tanks for sponsored by mostly by the rich countries of the world, they compile a leading index for their members, 25 or so countries that are members of the OECD. That index rose ever so slightly in August, but its growth rate has been weakening now for a number of months, suggesting that the global economy seems to have peaked out, at least in the short to medium term. It's not about to fall off a cliff, but it's not about to accelerate either. And indicator of economic sentiment in Germany and on the larger European Eurozone, compiled by the German think tank, the Center for European Economic Research, the Zentrum für Europäische Wirtschaftsforschung, ZEW. That index of sentiment fell rather sharply in the month of October, both for Germany and for the larger Eurozone, indicating that both Germany and the Eurozone are losing economic momentum. So they've been mounting something like a recovery, but that does seem to be losing steam. And finally, a longer-term measure. U.S. corporations have been doing very, very well in raking in the profits over the last several years. Profitability of U.S. corporations peaked out in 1997 and fell into 2001, which helped bring about the stock bubble bursting and the recession of 2000-2001. That measure had been recovering because companies had been keeping a very tight lid on costs, keeping a tight lid on wages and hiring and investment, keeping their shareholders happy by producing large profit gains. But if we look at the ratio of those profits to their long-term trend, it's way, way, way above trend now. And we've seen comparable peaks in the ratio of profits to their trend line in 1966, which was really the beginning of the end of the great post-World War II expansion. In 1997, the peak in the profit cycle, and now again. So it's this may be of some historic significance. It could mean that we're in for some somewhat more troubled economic times ahead. So let's take a little musical break and come back with Sebastian Mallaby in just a moment. And that a little excerpt from the Shostakovich first cello concerto, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't know who the performers were, but I thought a little cello music was appropriate for a segment about an amateur cellist, the World Bank's President James Wolfensohn. And we're joined now by Sebastian Mallaby, who is the author of the book The World's Banker, which is a biography or institutional biography of both the World Bank and its president, James Wolfensohn. Welcome to WBAI, Sebastian Mallaby.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And I'd like to, we've got you all set up in ISDN, so it sounds like you're right here, but you're actually in Washington, D.C. So the World Bank turned 60 years old a little while ago. That's normally nearing retirement age. This is an institution that when Wolfensohn took over was kind of troubled. And a lot of people have been calling for the bank to finally just retire one way or another. Do you think it's still a live institution, or is it really to be put out to pasture?
Well, you're asking exactly the right question, because back 10 years ago when Wolfensohn took the job of leading the World Bank, there had already been a whole campaign called the 50 Years is Enough campaign, arguing that the 50th anniversary would be the right time to close down this institution. But the bank has survived, and I hope it does survive, because I think if you didn't have it, you'd want to reinvent it. This is a group which has 10,000 people basically tackling the toughest problems in the world, from malnutrition to AIDS to broken down electricity systems all across the planet. It's basically got projects in nearly 100 countries. And I think that although the projects don't always succeed because fixing poverty is the toughest challenge in the world, nonetheless, it's probably better at its job than any comparable organization.
Well, if we look back at some of the great achievements of poverty reduction over the last couple of decades, mostly in East Asia, the bank didn't contribute all that much to those achievements. Where are the bank's successes?
Well, that's right. I mean, you're putting your finger on a key difficulty in defending almost any agent which is trying to contribute to development, whether you're talking about a private bank, or McKinsey, the management consultancy, or a particular non-governmental group which built some nice schools. You can't single out any actor in development and say, this was the group that really, really made the difference. And so it is too with the World Bank. If you look at the big East Asian success stories, I mean, I would put most of the credit, I'd give it mostly to the governments who led those economies to huge success, and secondly to the, you know, to the people who worked in them, the people of the country who really drive the progress by working hard and working productively and working creatively. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the World Bank had no input whatsoever. One example I look at in my book in some detail is the story of Uganda, which in the 1990s lifted 40%, cut poverty by 40%, which is really a remarkable achievement, especially given that it's an African example. And the World Bank did make some very specific contributions, which I think would not have happened if it hadn't been there. For example, it noticed that there was a problem with local schools not enrolling new pupils, even though Uganda's central government had, in fact, increased the budget for these schools. And what it did is that it designed a survey and figured out how much each local school was supposed to be getting in money from the central government, and then sent survey teams to go ask the local schools, well, how much did you actually get in terms of money? And the median school in the survey, the median school got 0% of what it was supposed to get. And that was discovered thanks to a World Bank idea for a World Bank survey done by World Bank number crunchers with World Bank spreadsheets. And the consequence of that survey was that the government of Uganda could then post on the notice boards of all the schools how much they were meant to be getting, which then mobilized the local parents to put pressure on the schools. Where did all this money go? Who were the corrupt officials who stole it? Who were the middlemen we need to be putting pressure on? And when this whole thing was resurveyed 5 years later, the median school was now getting 60% or 70% of what it was meant to get. So corruption was tangibly reduced. And there are lots of small examples like that across the developing world where, you know, a smart idea was brought to the development mixture by the World Bank and did make a difference.
Well, but the bank borrows billions on the world capital markets every year and pushes billions in loans out the door every year to its borrowing countries. But what you describe sounds like a fairly small-scale effort that doesn't need that kind of churning of capital. The bank's larger efforts, its project lending and its policy lending that it's come to be associated with over the last 20 years, what's the contribution of that?
Well, let's take another example from the same country. There was a time in the late 90s when Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, decided to really push for universal enrollment of kids in primary school. He was campaigning for an election. He realized that when he went out on the campaign trail, of all the things he said in his speech, more education was the most popular. And so he decided that this, you know, he pretty much made a commitment in the election to do it, leaving his finance ministry to figure out, well, how do we implement this? We don't have the money to pay for it. What do we do? And the finance ministry basically turned to the World Bank and said, look, we have this political obligation. If we do it, which is also, of course, a great development goal as well as being a political obligation, if we do it on our own resources, we can't afford it, so we'll have to print the money to pay for these new schools and these new teachers. If we print the money, we're going to have hyperinflation. If we have hyperinflation, the whole economy and all our anti-poverty efforts will go out the window. And the World Bank responded very quickly and gave a $100 million loan to finance this big push for universal education, which actually succeeded. So there again, I mean, there are examples that, like that sort of thing where a huge new enrollment of school children was made possible by World Bank finance. I'm not disagreeing with when you say that, look, you know, there's lots of program aid, it's harder to measure the results. That's because program aid, when you just give the money to a government's budget without specifying what it will go for, you can't say, well, here's the concrete schoolrooms or here's the particular health clinic that was built as a result. But that doesn't mean it wasn't important. I mean, I give you another example. East Asia, during the crisis, when those countries, you know, had currency collapses and private banks were pulling their money out, it helped that, for example, in the South Korean case, the World Bank chipped in as part of the sort of consortium that gave some emergency finance to South Korea to stabilize its currency. And then within a year or so, the South Koreans could pay the World Bank back, having gotten through the worst of its crisis.
Now, you're very hard on an economist, former World Bank chief economist, Joseph Stiglitz, who was very critical of the IMF for their work in that Asian crisis and also in Russia. When Stiglitz said, actually, on this program that by urging the Asian countries to raise their interest rates in the midst of a financial panic, that actually contributed to bankruptcy and economic collapse. I asked him why the IMF economist made such advice, and he said there's no room for bankruptcy in their models. Now, you recite something like that and say that Stiglitz didn't know what he was talking about. Could you rehearse your critique of Stiglitz?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not. Of course, he knows what he's talking about. I mean, we're talking about a Nobel laureate here. He absolutely knows what he's talking about. But what I think in his public presentations around the time of the Asian crisis, he wasn't acknowledging that the reason the IMF was not making the policy choices that he advocated was because there were legitimate and difficult trade-offs involved. For example, you go to a country like Thailand, which was facing a currency collapse. The World Bank's, sorry, the IMF's advice was stop the currency collapse by tightening your budget, tightening your monetary policy, so that investors who hold this foreign exchange will not think the economy is going to be inflationary and so forth, they will keep their money in, and you will stabilize the currency. And Stiglitz says, that's crazy. You've got this financial crisis. If you tighten your monetary policy, the likely bankruptcy of your companies will get even worse because you're running tighter monetary policy. You must be nuts to do this. But the point is that there was also the counter-argument at the time, which was that the falling value of the currency itself was driving bankruptcies. So either way, you had a risk of more bankruptcies. If you told them not to tighten the monetary policy, the currency might fall even more and cause even worse trouble. If you told them to tighten it, you got what happened, which is that you also got more bankruptcies. So what I was saying in my book is that Stiglitz attacked the IMF extremely aggressively. He was right in a couple of counts, but the tone of his attacks was over the top. And this was part of a bigger story I was trying to tell about how the World Bank and the IMF, which were obviously founded together as sister institutions 60 years ago, were sort of rivals during this period. And partly that comes down to the character of Jim Wolfensohn, the World Bank president, who couldn't resist trying to be number one, trying to elbow the International Monetary Fund in the ribs whenever possible. So when the IMF was trying to handle this Asian crisis, which was an incredibly hard challenge, and then some of its policies went wrong, the bank sort of, took the chance to kick the IMF while it was down, and Joe Stiglitz was part of that approach.
Of course, the United States had a stock market collapse earlier, three or four years ago. The response from our policymakers was very, very low interest rates and gigantic tax cuts. So that's not the same kind of advice the IMF would dispense to a country facing a financial crisis.
Sure, but I mean, it's a totally different example. In the United States case, we have the global reserve currency here. Everyone wants to hold dollars. There's no danger that if you loosen monetary policy, everyone's suddenly going to start, dumping all their dollars. And, even if you had a tiny bit of that, it's such a big and liquid market for the US dollar that you wouldn't face that problem. When the stock market collapsed here, we were not in a dollar crash at the same time. These East Asian economies were in the middle of a currency crash, right? So the prescription was necessarily different.
Wealth has its privileges. Let's talk about the star of your book, James Wolfensohn. Wolfensohn had established a very successful career for himself as an investment banker, and then made a major transition to be the president of the world's leading development organization. What kind of institution did he find when he took over?
He made many transitions in his life. Let me just talk about that for a second. I mean, he's a man who, represented his country in the Olympics, plays the cello on the stage of Carnegie Hall with the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, had a network which went from the Dalai Lama to Harrison Ford, had made more than $100 million on Wall Street. And so coming to the World Bank and taking on yet another challenge was sort of, part of his whole style. He's a kind of Renaissance man figure. And he came, you know, with enormous self-confidence, an enormous sense of kind of, you know, he'd never met a challenge in his life that he hadn't succeeded at brilliantly. And he was determined to do the same at the World Bank. But some of his ambitions to sort of turn the place around, which, because when he arrived in 1995, it was encircled by critics of both left and right. It was unpopular, and it was sort of internally sluggish, and the, you know, its management left something to be desired. Wolfensohn came in and thought that he could revolutionize it. So he would walk down the corridors in the early days and accost a random manager and say, "I'm surprised you're still here," and then leave the poor guy to figure out if he'd just been fired or not. So there was, you know, a kind of very aggressive collision between this sort of messianic Renaissance man, newcomer, Jim Wolfensohn, and the very established, you know, kind of venerable World Bank, which took to this newcomer with some resentment.
And has he managed to turn the place around? Has he, or is the thing just sort of careening, still out of control?
Well, no, Wolfensohn is the kind of person who certainly turns it around. He might have spun it around so many times that it got disorientated, but there was a lot of churning. I mean, he, for example, came in and said immediately that the World Bank should offer debt relief to the poorest countries. This was a complete shattering of the taboo. Before, if you mentioned debt relief in the World Bank, you were sort of putting your career on the line. There was an example of a World Bank study which had been done, which just sort of discussed hypothetically perhaps the possibility of maybe some debt relief. And when one of the top people at the bank discovered this, the entire report, all the copies of it, were kind of withdrawn and pulped. It was that level of taboo about discussing debt relief. And Wolfensohn said, "This is ridiculous. I'm going to do it." And he put it on the agenda, and he was accused by people at the International Monetary Fund of, you know, destabilizing the financial system. He just ignored all that and did it. So that's one example of the change he wrought. Another one is that he put corruption on the agenda. Corruption had been, again, a taboo at the World Bank because it considered itself an economic institution only, and it refused to acknowledge that. It's not just a question of fixing inflation in a poor country or getting your budget right or whatever. If you want to make progress, you also need for government people not to be stealing money corruptly from the citizens of the country. And Wolfensohn made a big speech the year after he got to the World Bank called the Cancer of Corruption speech, in which he put this on the agenda and again changed the orientation of the bank. And he also made big efforts to shake up the management. He arrived, as I said, in 1995, and it was the time, if you remember, of huge confidence in the private sector model. There was a sort of sense during that financial bubble of the mid-late 1990s that not only was there a kind of bubble in share prices, but it's a psychological bubble in the reputation of corporate America. And he, I think, fell prey to that. He tried to import private sector management ideas and brought in kind of company chief executives to advise him how to do this, and rather lost sight of the fact that in a public institution like the World Bank, you can't necessarily always make that work. And I think, you know, there's a similar story in the New York Police Department, perhaps, with Bratton's innovations, some of which worked, some of which didn't. But he was very much inspired by kind of lectures at Harvard Business School and trying to bring in that private sector thinking. You know, Al Gore's book, Reinventing Government, was on the bestseller list of the New York Times, amazingly enough, if you think about it, a sort of management term for the public sector selling that well. And this was really the spirit of the times, and Wolfensohn was part of this. So he tried to revolutionize the management. I think that's one of his less successful attempts at innovation.
Let's take a little station break, and we'll be back in about 10 seconds.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. WBAI, 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
And we're back. The show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're speaking with Sebastian Mallaby, who's the author of the book The World's Banker, biography of James Wolfensohn and the institution he heads, the World Bank, recently published by the Penguin Press. And The World Bank is not a popular institution in lots of the world. Certainly, a lot of the of its client countries, it's at least a large portion of the population view it as not a spreader of beneficence, but a spreader of trouble. And a large movement has grown up in opposition to the bank's policies. Certainly, you know, Latin America would be very hard to point to any great economic success stories over the last 20 years associated with the bank. What's your response to the people who criticized the bank for dispensing more austerity than development?
Well, of course, you have to separate out the critics a little bit. I mean, the irony about the World Bank is that it's a public sector institution advocating privatization and kind of market, free market economics. And so people on the right hate it because it's a public sector institution, and people on the left hate it because it's a believer in free market economics. Now, I think, you know, if you're talking about the Latin American view of the World Bank, for example, what you get more of is the sort of more left-wing response, which is to say, you know, you've been preaching these free market ideas, and we've been implementing them, and it's cost us a lot in terms of austerity. And people have been thrown out of work because we've had to fire government workers on your advice because you told us to cut our budget deficit. And you promised that this would yield economic growth. And I'm sorry, but it hasn't. So you've messed us up. I mean, that's the sort of classic critique. And I mean, I think the answer to it is that what caused the necessity to implement this economic austerity is not actually the World Bank. And it's like shooting the messenger. The World Bank may have brought the message, but what caused the necessity was that there were economies that were totally out of kilter and had been since the second oil shock, which was what really pushed the whole of Latin America and much of the developing world into this terrible 1980s lost decade, followed by a 1990s, which wasn't a whole lot better. It was the second oil shock at the start of at the end of the 70s, followed by the Mexican default and the debt crisis in the beginning of the 80s, which really triggered all of that. And it's a bit like saying, you know, we've got a lot of cancer in the world, and so we should probably blame the doctors because they're the ones who have told us that we've got cancer. And that's, I think, a fair analogy for how the World Bank gets blamed.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that it's not the cancer is the problem; it's that the treatment is the problem. That we've had 20 or 25 years of structural adjustment and promised transition to growth that just hasn't really materialized. Or we've seen the case of Mexico or Argentina: brief periods of growth followed by crises. So maybe it's time to dispense with the advice and go their own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that countries that have tried to go their own way and follow a sort of entirely alternative, you know, state-led development model in Latin America have not succeeded. So I'm not sure that's really a terribly promising avenue. The biggest clear success story in Latin America is obviously Chile, which has followed pretty much the World Bank orthodoxy.
Although there's some intense political unpleasantness in Chile about 30 years ago.
But I thought we were talking about the last 15 years or so. I mean, the dictatorship in Chile has not been in power for when it faded out in the 80s, right?
Right. But there's
we've had 15 years.
Well, we've had years of up and down in Chile, but the gains in Chile have not been all that equitably distributed either. I mean, poor people in Chile have not really partaken in large measures of the boom there.
I don't have the numbers in my head about Chile. I would think it's unlikely that the poverty has not been reduced in Chile. I mean, if you look globally, between 1990 and 2015, we are actually on track for halving the proportion of people living in extreme poverty. And that's a success which I'm not claiming is entirely the doing of the World Bank. Far from it. But I'm saying that, you know, countries which have had serious growth, particularly in East Asia, do tend also to reduce poverty. Countries which don't have growth don't reduce poverty. And therefore, the most important thing to do if you care about poverty is to advocate policies which will deliver broad economic growth. And that's what the World Bank is trying to do.
In your book, well, some of the leading critics of the World Bank and James Wolfensohn have been non-governmental organizations, NGOs, particularly those based in the rich countries, North America and Western Europe. And you're very critical of the NGOs as a group. What's your beef with the NGOs?
I'm quite positive on some of them. I'd like to just make that clear first before we get into the other half, which I know you want to get into. I mean, there are some like Oxfam, which come off in my book extremely well. I regard Oxfam as a great organization, which has led the campaigns on debt relief, led campaigns to get more aid from rich countries, and actually run some extremely good projects in developing countries. So I'm not against all NGOs, all non-governmental groups, by any stretch of the imagination. I am critical in my book about certain examples of campaigns against World Bank projects, which I think if you look at the detail, were not really founded on accurate facts. My favorite example comes from China, where the World Bank was going to back a project in 1999, which was going to move 58,000 extremely poor farmers from soil which was so degraded they couldn't really grow any food to another area where there would be good enough soil that they could actually feed their families. And this project was one of 30 or so projects to move people in this way. And all of the other ones which had been done before had indeed reduced poverty a lot. So when the World Bank came to do this 33rd example of the same kind of idea, it thought it was pretty routine, negotiated the loan, and then lo and behold, a huge advocacy movement based in Europe and the United States jumped on the bank's head and said, no, you can't do that because this is going to be terrible for Tibet. The Tibetan culture is going to be destroyed. This relocation of farmers is really about the relocation of Han Chinese into traditional Tibetan lands to eradicate Tibetan culture. Now, of course, it's a fact that Chinese policy towards Tibet is awful. So when you say that kind of thing, naturally you get a lot of allies. And, you know, important Tibetans like Richard Gere joined in this campaign against the World Bank. There was Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, with the campaign and against the World Bank. There was Christopher Cox, Republican of California, also prominently with this campaign and against the World Bank. And there was so much pressure on the bank that after a long fight, maybe it took about a year or something, and a lot of expensive further studies to show that the project was or was not good, finally the bank had to pull out and couldn't do this project because it was going to be so harmful to Tibetans. Now the catch is that the project was not in Tibet. It was in a province next to Tibet, and one in five of the people there are Tibetan ethnically, but it really was not a project which was going to harm Tibetans by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, so the premise of the campaign was faulty, and yet the campaign persuaded enough people in Congress and in the media, people like me, journalists, to believe it and to write about it and to support it, that ultimately there was such a firestorm the bank had to pull out. And my worry is, you know, that if the World Bank pulls out of these projects, often they go ahead, and you know, the Chinese said afterwards actually on this one, hey, we'll do it anyway. We don't need the World Bank. We'll just go ahead and relocate these people. Except they did it without the environmental protections which had been built into the project because of the World Bank's participation, without some of the social protections. They did it much less well. So if you care about the environment, this was a bad outcome. If you care about human rights, it was a bad outcome. And if you care about poverty reduction, it was a bad outcome. So I just caution in my book that merely because an organization appears to be, you know, feisty, committed, small, idealistic, one shouldn't necessarily believe what it's saying in preference to the sort of faceless corporate World Bank, which is the object of so much suspicion.
And that book is The World's Banker by the author who's speaking, Sebastian Mallaby. And you're also very critical specifically of the International Rivers Network and some work they did in Uganda. So we have a Patrick McCulley of IRN waiting on the line. So tell us the IRN story as you see it.
Absolutely. Do you want me to talk about the
yes.
Uganda part?
Yeah, please tell your side of the story first.
This is a story about a dam project in Uganda called the Bujagali Dam. And it was conceived because Uganda has a chronic shortage of electricity. And in fact, you know, electricity had been identified as one of the big bottlenecks to growth in Uganda. It was very difficult to get investment because if you put up any factory-created jobs, you would need electricity to keep the factory running. And without that, You wouldn't do the factory in the first place. So there was going to be a big growth impact, a big poverty reduction impact from the industrial use of electricity. And after much consultation, much looking around, the World Bank and the Ugandan government came to the conclusion that a good way of creating this electricity would be to build a dam at this place called Bujagali. Now, along the way, all sorts of things happened to delay the construction of this dam. There was, there was a corruption scandal later on, which delayed the whole project, and there were some other issues. But among the reasons for the delay was that the International Rivers Network, based in California, was campaigning against the dam, opposing it. And among the reasons given for their opposition was, first of all, that there was a broad Ugandan movement against this dam, and that therefore International Rivers Network sort of said it was speaking on behalf of a popular movement in Uganda. And secondly, that the people around the dam would be cruelly displaced and that they would be uprooted from their lives and from their land and that, they would suffer abuses as a result of the project. And the thing is that, I'd been in Washington working for the Washington Post for quite a while. I'd worked for The Economist magazine before that. I'd been, a journalist interested in development for a long time, but often not in the remote location where the project is situated. And so you receive press releases from NGOs, and you tend to believe them, because why would you not? Why would somebody make any of this stuff up? But on this particular occasion, I was in Uganda, so I wanted to go see the local environmental group, which was cited by International Rivers Network as its local partner. So I went along to see this group, and I sat in the office, talked to this nice guy, and after a while, I asked the question I really wanted to know, which is, well, what kind of organization are you? Oh, we're a membership organization, he said. Oh, really? How many members do you have? And so the man got up and looked in his drawer in his desk and pulled out a little book and opened it up, and there handwritten was all the names of the members of his organization, of whom there were 25. And it just struck me that, 25 people is not a broad basis on which to oppose electricity, which could benefit a whole economy. And then I went to the site of the dam with I hooked up with a Ugandan sociologist from the local university who said she would translate for me, and we went around this dam site, and we talked to people who would be relocated if the dam did go ahead, and we said, are you happy or are you not happy? And they basically all said, well, we've been offered financial compensation if we move, so we can buy new land, and the financial deal seems quite good, and we're pretty much happy with it. So after four or five interviews like this, my sociologist companion, who I should say began by being against the dam, when we set off together in the car, she said she thought it was a bad idea. She said, well, maybe we have a sample bias because we're interviewing the men and we should go speak to the women too, because sometimes the men might get the financial payoff and the women get stuck without the land. So we interviewed some women and they were also in favor of the dam. And in this tour around the area, the only people we found who were unhappy with things were people who were outside of the dam's perimeter, outside of the project perimeter, and therefore not being offered financial compensation and not being offered a chance to be relocated. So all I did in my book is that I just reported these facts as I witnessed them directly, which were not in keeping with what I had been led to believe by the International River Network before I had gone to investigate. And I just use this as an example to point out the way that we in the public need to be a little bit skeptical about what we hear from all kinds of sources. You should be skeptical what you read in the newspaper, and you should also be skeptical what you hear from non-governmental groups. And you shouldn't necessarily assume that just because the World Bank is doing something and it's being criticized, that the critics are correct.
All right, well, and we now have Patrick McCauley from the International Rivers on the Network been listening to all this on the line. Patrick, what's your response to what you just heard?
It's a lot of distortions of the truth going on there. I certainly agree that it's always good to be skeptical, and what we read on the papers and of what different advocates say. And when you're going to be skeptical, you got to research the fact. You got to find out what is actually going on, read some documents, and Mr. Malby really hasn't done that in this case. He knows extremely little about the project, it seems. First of all, this issue of the role of the Ugandan NGOs, Ugandan environmentalist opponents of the dam. It's really quite shocking to say that the only people who criticized this dam was were 30 or 25 environmentalists. There's a lot of opposition to this project in Uganda. I've been there. Other people from my organization have been there. We've talked to parliamentarians. We've talked to local people. We've talked to these people that have been resettled. We've talked to local business people. We've talked to members of parliament. There is a lot of concern about this project. A lot of those people were concerned about speaking out because the government very strongly wanted to build it. It was a very politicized project. It was started off not through any very rational process of planning, but more because the chief executives of the U.S. power company, AES, met President Museveni from Uganda at a prayer breakfast in the U.S. and decided that they could get together and build this dam. World Bank was very keen on it for various reasons, including, as Mr. Malby documents in his book, that AES were a very influential company with the World Bank, including because of their very modern management style they had was influential at the bank. So this project was dreamed up despite the fact there had been no proper assessment of what the various alternatives, what were the best options for Uganda. Now, we know, of course we know, that Uganda has a huge need for power. There is only 5% Ugandan population has access to electricity. It's a serious constraint on development there. But there is no point providing power to people if they can't afford it. And that was the assessment of people in Uganda and ourselves and some independent experts that we commissioned to look at the studies we could get of the project, was that it was extremely economically risky. And, more importantly, there were other alternatives, including another dam site downstream, which was probably going to be cheaper. Probably going to have less local impacts. There was also geothermal power in Uganda, which the bank admitted the resource was there, but wasn't prepared to put any work into. And it was a very good thing for Uganda that there was this brave group of environmentalists who were prepared to speak out. And they're not a mass-based movement. Uganda doesn't have that. It's not possible. It's a strange sort of democracy, a sort of a one-party or one-movement democracy.
Uganda is usually presented as a great miracle of poverty reduction. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, there are great. The government has achieved great things in terms of poverty reduction. I mean, Uganda suffered horribly in the, through this, especially through the 70s and 80s, through this dictators like Idi Amin and Obote, and it was a total mess. And Museveni, absolutely no doubt, has been a huge improvement in what's gone before, and there have been a lot of advances, but it's also very important not to take Uganda as this sort of prime example and say the government is the best thing that happened and nobody should criticize it. It's absolutely vital for development that you do have democracy, that you have the possibility of political debate. And that's what the Bujagali project has all been about. It's been a chance to actually get documents out in the open to criticize a government decision. In this case, the NGOs in Uganda were able to go to the court, and they used the courts to be able to get this key project document made public. This was the power purchase agreement between the American company AES and the Ugandan government. The World Bank, nobody else would tell us what was in that document. Without that document, we didn't know what the economic terms were. When finally we were able to get it, we were able to analyze it and see that this was a really shoddy deal for Uganda. And even at that point, people in the Ugandan government sort of started to back away from the project, and now things are looking quite promising in Uganda, and there is now a serious effort to look at this downstream project, which we understand in another confidential document, which we haven't been able to get our hands on, but some others and some journalists in Norway have seen it and say that it has inflated by $200 million the cost of this other dam downstream, therefore making the dam downstream not look viable when a lot of people are saying actually it's much cheaper and a much better deal and less destructive and better in terms of development. Anyway, now it looks like the government is saying, yes, they are interested in looking at this other project. Now this money is going into geothermal energy. This organization, which Mr. Malby is so dismissive about, they're called NAPE, the National Association of Professional Environmentalists. They don't pretend to be a mass membership organization. Their membership is professionals in Kampala mainly, near to where the Bujagali Dam is. They helped organize a workshop in geothermal power in Uganda. They got the government along to it. The government is now committed to doing more work in geothermal. Overall, the Bujagali campaign has also been very good in Uganda because it has strengthened the role of independent voices there. I think there is now a stronger civil society in Uganda than there was before this project, and it's a very good thing. But what Mr. Malby is doing is very dangerous because it just plays into the hand of attempts by the government to shut people up. This group, the opponents of the dam in Uganda, have been called enemies of the state, and the president has said he's going to war with them, and we know what that can mean. That can mean, you know, it can mean threats against people. It can mean eventually imprisonment. It can mean beatings. We see that in different countries. So it's an extremely irresponsible position. And it's been used in Uganda. The government newspaper in Uganda has reprinted some of Mr. Malawi's stuff and is using that as an attack against the NGOs to say how much harm they've caused Uganda. And it's totally not true.
Well, Sebastian Malawi, this sounds a lot more reasonable than what you present. What's your response?
Which bit do you think sounds more reasonable? Which bit would you like me to prioritize?
Well, that there are alternatives downstream, and that geothermal is a cheaper and more ecologically responsible approach.
Sure. I'm in favor of alternative sources of power. I think that there should be a gas tax in the United States. I think there should be a much bigger investment in getting away from hydrocarbons. And the Middle East shows yet again another reason for thinking that. What I'm concerned about is the idea that the poorest countries in the world should be in the forefront of saving us from ozone destruction. I mean, we in the north need to do our part, first of all.
But
Doug is asking the question.
All right, well, okay, let's Sebastian speak
a little bit. What I'm trying to say is that in a poor country like Uganda, one has to balance the need for development, for poverty reduction, against environmental concerns.
Patrick Cully is saying there are more economical and more ecologically responsible alternatives, so this dam proposal, as it stood, struck out on both grounds, and that there are better alternatives on both grounds.
Right. I mean, I don't think the claim is that geothermal power by itself is more economical.
Yeah.
Let me just back up a second. It seems to me that underlying a lot of this discussion is the idea that the World Bank's support for a project is sort of, necessarily suspect. The World Bank is an organization with people who work there because they do actually want to reduce global poverty. I mean, they have engineering PhDs, economics PhDs. They could have taken these things and been paid a lot of money in the private sector. They work in the World Bank because they actually do care about the poor countries. And when they support a project and they say, let's build the dam here rather than there, they're doing it because they actually think it will reduce poverty more and it will be better for the country. And whenever you propose any kind of big infrastructure project, it's always going to be possible to second guess it, to say, well, you could have done it over here, over there, over there. To my mind, you need to have that debate. I'm absolutely with Mr. McCulley when he says, you need to have open debate about this. You want a vibrant civil society which will have input into this debate. I think it's good that the power purchase agreement was made public. And I think he's on very strong ground on all those points there. But my concern is that at the end of the day, everybody needs to agree that we're going to do a project. We're going to come to closure on these discussions about how we do a project, and we're actually going to go forward because there are, after all, 3 billion people in the world who live on $2 a day, and they can't wait forever.
All right. We've only got a minute left, so Patrick McCulley, you get the last word, another minute or so.
That's absolutely the point. These people can't wait forever, and we have this bias. It's inside the World Bank. It's inside a lot of governments and corporations for various reasons towards building big projects that are not the best option for various reasons to do. Sometimes it's corruption, it's vested interests. And in the case of Bujagali, the strange confluence of President Museveni and the head of American corporation being born-again Christians and meeting at a prayer breakfast, there's a lot more that goes into project selection than just a lot of decent chaps inside the World Bank with a PhD deciding where the best place to put a project is. It's a complex, politicized process. There must be public scrutiny of the PhDs within the World Bank and the people within governments and, of course, of NGOs as well. And unfortunately, Mr. Malawi is doing a great disservice to the debate that he claims to want, because he's basically trying to shut down NGOs and trying to shut down public debate in these projects, and that's only going to harm the poor.
I'm not trying to shut down NGOs. That's ridiculous.
You refer to us as...
You should not
be listened to.
You,
sounds like a shutdown.
Well, I think if you make claims which aren't true when checked, then I think that perhaps
you
shouldn't be listened to.
That, Mr. Mowley.
All right. Well, this could go on forever, and unfortunately it can't because we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, both of you. I've been speaking with Sebastian Mellaby, author of the book The World's Banker, about James Wolfensohn and the institution he heads, the World Bank, just published by Penguin Press, and also by Patrick McCulley, joining us from the International Rivers Network in Berkeley, California. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Thanks to both of you. I'm off next week, but I'll be back in 2 weeks for the fundraiser, so stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with a little more of Shostakovich's cello concerto in honor of the amateur cellist James Wolfensohn.